Topic, we are going to be doing the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah, the principles of faith. And there's a lot to do here. I will briefly outline my plan. We'll see if I succeed in accomplishing my plan, but I'd like to do this topic over 2 weeks. The first week, that is today, we will be briefly introduce the concept of Ikarim and hopefully read through what most of them are and briefly describe some of the issues that pertain to them. And next week, I would like to spend the entire class on a central question concerning Ikarim, which is why the Rambam says at the end, again, this is what we'll do next week, that anyone who doesn't believe in these 13 principles does not have a chelik in Olam Haba, is not part of the Jewish people and the like. Why is that true? And specifically, why should it be the case if someone has incorrect beliefs as the result of faulty reasoning? Do we say, Ones Rachmana Patre, that God forgives those who are Ones, meaning to say it's not their fault? What happens if someone comes to the conclusion that God has a physical body because of their simple reading of the text, or they deny the validity of the oral law or the like? How do we treat those? There is a general approach to the way that the Rambam is understood. I don't believe that. We'll present different approaches, how the Rambam, this is my copy, how the Rambam could be understood. So that question, in other words, a question of why we need Ikarim and what happens if someone denies the Ikarim, and why do we term such a person a heretic, and what is gained by that, and the like, I'd like to do those questions next week. This week, we'll describe the Ikarim and again, point out some nuances. So that's the agenda.
I guess we'll come across the question of some of these are listed in the Sefer Mitzvot or in the Mishnah Torah, and some are not.
That is an excellent question. I don't know if we'll have a chance to deal with that, but it is a very good question. For example, in Hilchos Tshuva, when he goes and discusses the various things that are make a person a heretic or the like, he mentioned some of the Ikarim and not others. Somebody asked last week, I think it was you, why free will isn't mentioned.
Right.
This is a question that we may or may not have time to deal with, but they are certainly important questions. Okay, so that's our...
Why do you select the Rambam's Ikarim?
Okay, I'd like to do...
He'd rather do it with Valbo.
Right, it's just three. The main reason, I would say, is because it's by far the most widely accepted. And moreover, he was the first to do it. There was no one before the Rambam, and in a moment, that's actually a question I'd like to deal with today, which is why is it that the Rambam is the first person to codify a list? What does that indicate? And that's a question we'll get to in a minute. But I think that if you're going to do any of them, it would make most sense to do the Rambam. He didn't have it as a list. In other words, there's no, as far as I know, I might be mistaken, Rav Sadia Gaon, throughout his commentary, Emunos Fideos, will tell you this is an important faith, this is something that you have to believe in, this is the truth, but he doesn't make a list. These are the lists of Ikarei Emunah, as far as I know. Okay. Let's start, though, with the context. And the context, where does the Rambam actually tell you that there are these 13 principles of faith? He does so in his commentary on the Mishnah, and specifically on the Mishnah, the first Mishnah in Perek HaChelek, which is either the 11th or 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, depending on your version. And the Mishnah says as follows. Where was the Rambam getting this idea that belief is relevant? In other words, there is a perspective that people have that belief is not important to Judaism. Judaism is a religion that's always focused on practice and not on belief. And where does the Rambam then get this idea that belief is important? So the Rambam actually makes these comments initially in his commentary on the following Mishnah in Sanhedrin. So the Mishnah says, we'll start with the Mishnah before we get to the Rambam's commentary. The Mishnah says the following. Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelak li'olam haba. All Jewish people have a portion in the world to come. Shenemar v'amech kulam tzadikim li'olam yershu aretz netzer matai masei adai lehispa'er. We talked about this Mishnah a little bit previously when we read, when we discussed Olam Haba. The basis of the of this concept of Kol Yisrael Yeshlam Chelak Olam Haba is because the Pasuk says, V'amech kulam tzadikim, your entire nation is righteous. And then the Pasuk continues, Li'olam yershu aretz. They will inherit the land eternally. The Talmud understands that inheritance of the land is a reference, is an allusion to Olam Haba. Earlier, several weeks ago, we discussed why it is that Olam Haba is not described more explicitly in the Torah, but Yerushas Haaretz is an allusion, and the fact that it says Li'olam indicates it's eternal. Ve'elo she'en lahem chelak l'olam haba. People like singing the first half of the song, that they forget the second, the continuation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, but the following people do not have a portion in the world to come. The language of the Mishnah is striking, because it should say chutz mi X, Y, and Z. Instead it says ve'elo. The simple understanding of this, though there's more to discuss here, is that a person has Olam Haba by dint of their being a Yisrael, not because of anything that they did. And that's why it states it as Kol Yisrael Yeshlam Chelak Olam Haba. This is an idea in the Rambam, since we're doing the Rambam today. By being a Yisrael, you have a Chelak Olam Haba. And it's only if you remove yourself from Yisrael by doing or believing particular things that you lose your portion in Olam Haba. And that's why the Mishnah is said this way. If it was said in the standard way of Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelak Olam Haba Chutz Mi X, Y, and Z, so you wouldn't recognize that the Olam Haba is simply a result of their being Yisrael. So it's only those who remove themselves from Yisrael that have no Chelak. And this is an idea that we'll see the Rambam at the end. So who are they? So number one is Ha'omer Ein Tchias HaMesim Min HaTorah. Someone who denies the resurrection. Interestingly enough, it doesn't just say Ha'omer Ein Tchias HaMesim, but it says Ha'omer Ein Tchias HaMesim Min HaTorah. In other words, if you acknowledge its existence, but you deny that it's from the Torah, that too is heretical and causes a person to lose their chelak in Olam Haba. So first and foremost, before we even proceed with the list, we see that the Mishnah designates that certain denial of certain beliefs warrants lack of Olam Haba. So certainly it is the case that the Rambam did not make this up. It's coming from the Mishnah. Now, the Rambam did make up the list of 13, but the idea that Ikare Emuna are necessary, and moreover that denial of Ikare Emuna can lead to the situation of Ein Lo Chelak L'Olam Haba is not a chiddush. It's not the chiddush of the Rambam. It's clear from the Mishnah. The Rambam expands this list, and we'll read on in the Mishnah. We could wonder, it's a very interesting question, why is it that the Mishnah focuses first and foremost on Olam Haba or on Tchias HaMesim? What is so important about the resurrection? We dealt with that a little bit last time. But again, the notion that that Judaism expects belief and that denial of core beliefs is a very significant thing is clear from the Mishnah. Many of you have probably read Professor Kellner's work on this topic, where he argues against that.
Which person?
Menachem Kellner, from the University of Haifa, and he tries to answer this question. I don't understand his theory at all, but it's an interesting read. The Mishnah continues. There are others. For example, Ve'en Torah Min HaShamayim. Someone denies the fact that the Torah is Min HaShamayim. Now, on a simple level, there are probably deeper answers to this question, but on a simple level, these two are picked at first because these were the commonly denied concepts at the time of the writing of the Mishnah. Meaning to say that, and we see this from the Talmud and the like, there were people that denied Tchias HaMesim, and therefore the Mishnah has to stress that those who deny Tchias HaMesim, Ein Lam Chelak L'Olam Haba, there are those who denied Torah Min HaShamayim, and therefore the Mishnah stresses these as well. It's obvious that if we're going to say that the denial of Tchias HaMesim means Ein Lo Chelek L'Olam Haba, that denial of God's existence is going to lead to Ein Lo Chelek L'Olam Haba. That's certainly a Kal Vachomer. But the Mishnah doesn't need to say that, because that was not the issue they were struggling with and dealing with at the time. There are deeper answers. Perhaps we'll consider them later. So
is it possible that you could have Olam Haba separate from Tchias HaMesim, or Tchias HaMesim without having Olam Haba?
That's a question that we did when we did Olam Haba. The Rambam's conception is that Tchias HaMesim has nothing to do with Olam Haba. The mainstream approach in Rishonim is that Tchias HaMesim ushers in the period of Olam Haba. The mainstream position is more or less explicit in the Talmud. One is actually one of the places where that's explicitly made clear is on this Mishnah. The Mishnah here says, the Gemara on this Mishnah says, why is it that Ha'omer Ein Tchias HaMesim Ein Lo Chelek Lom Haba? And the Gemara says, Hu Kafar Balafikach Lo Ye Lo Chelek Bo. Since he denied it, therefore he doesn't have a portion in it. That clearly equates the two.
Yeah.
The Rambam denies that equation, and when we get to the Rambam's discussion of the 13th principle, we'll get back to that point.
So-called mainstream opinions.
The Ramban and Rama are the first to elaborate on the notion that this is true and that the Rambam's position is untenable with Chazal. But subsequently, that's the dominant opinion. There were others besides the Rambam who maintained this distinction. Ibn Gabirol is the first that I know of. But as I said, it's the minority position. Okay. Again, we'll get back to this.
Tchias HaMesim presupposes that there was some place where the neshama is.
Everybody agrees. There's no doubt.
Before
there's no
the time of Tchias HaMesim.
Correct.
We haven't had Tchias HaMesim yet.
Exactly. There is no, among all Jewish thinkers, till modern times at the very least, there's never been any question pertaining to the Nitzchias HaNeshama, the eternality of the soul.
Okay.
And as we mentioned again when we did this in this year a couple weeks ago, that's explicit in the Torah that the soul continues to exist even after it separates from the body, even after death. You see that, for example, in the stories in Tanakh where there are encounters with the soul after death. Nevas, or the like, Shaul.
It's in the first few pages of the Siddur.
Yes. So,
that's more familiar to me than all these other places.
It's true. I once heard from Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs, he pointed out that it's interesting that the Chazal generally tried to express the important Ikari Amuna in Tefillah. Like you mentioned, many of them come out through Tefillah. You see that in terms of Tchias HaMesim, the fact that there's a bracha, the second bracha of Shemona Esrei is the bracha of Tchias HaMesim. That they didn't write books of philosophy. Instead, they dealt and they promulgated these beliefs through and in the tefillah. The third example in the Mishnah is an apikores. The word apikores comes from either the word hefker, that's the Rambam's theory, or others say it's from the Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, who was a denier of, obviously, many of the fundamental faiths, and that's why the Apikores, he was zocha to that name, that term. And okay, for now, we'll leave that. The Mishnah does continue. So, after commenting on that Mishnah, the Rambam writes, Umima sheraui sheazkir kan, v'zehu ha-makom ha-yoter ra'ui la-azkir rambo. This is the best place for me to discuss this. Shikare Torasenu ha-tehorah v'yisodosah shalosh esrei yisodos. The Ikare Torasenu are these 13 principles. Now, as you mentioned and earlier, there are a lot of questions. Why did he not include this? Why did he not include that? Maybe we could discuss some of them, but we'll focus on the things that he does say. This is from Parash HaMishnayos.
You gave the reference. I just wanted to show it was Parash HaMishnayos.
Correct. Now, before we actually begin reading them, we're going to briefly deal with a question that everybody that considers this matter wonders, and in fact leads a Professor Kellner to his position, which is why is it that nobody before the Rambam decided to do this? And should we be doing this? We know that the Rambam's positions, Yud Gimel Ikarim, became very widespread and widely accepted. Again, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Professor Shapiro's work on the debate within the Yud Gimel Ikarim, and we'll have a chance to address some of his claims. Mark Shapiro.
That's what I assume you meant. Okay.
Where
and
who is he and where?
Mark Shapiro is a professor at
Scranton,
and he's a brilliant person with tremendous bakias.
He appears as a lecturer in Teaneck from time to time at Davar.
So he's when I say tremendous bakias, you'll see that when you read his footnotes and in his works especially, that he's extraordinarily well-read. And he has a book in which he claims that all of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah were debated. Now, there is a significant distinction between debate before the Rambam and after the Rambam. There's a question in terms of evolution and the like, and I'd like to address some of his points. Again, I disagree to a large degree with his thesis, and so you shouldn't trust me. I'll try to present his position and why I think it's wrong, but by all means you should read his book. It's a great book. It started off as an article in the Torah Mada Journal, and then he elaborated it and expanded. Limits of Orthodoxy. Okay. And certainly, as I said, he's a world class scholar, whether or not you agree with his positions. But we'll get to that shortly. So the first question that again one wonders about is, if these 13 principles have become so popular, so important, then why is it that no one before the Rambam formulated them? There are many subsequent to the Rambam, we have the Sefer Ikrim, which distills them into three and says, but these three reflect, and he has certain disagreements. There are couple hundred years later, there was the Ani Mamins, which were written to sort of summarize that. Some people even say them at the end of davening or other prayers, like Yigdal, which is a brief summation in a poetic form of the Ikari Emunah. There are those who disagree.
Yigdal is attributed to whom?
I forget the name of the author, but that we know.
How close are these two to the original?
They're summaries. We'll see the original, and you'll read Yigdal, and you'll see. It's so, not...
There's at least one mistake in Yigdal.
What's the mistake?
Lichol Notzar. I mean, I consider it a mistake. Everybody should daven to Hashem. Vichol Notzar should daven to Hashem. Lichol Notzar means Hashem is one to every Notzar, and doesn't anything about davening.
Okay.
I mean, there's no subject going with the verb.
I understand. Obviously, all of these will not be able to capture everything, because the Rambam is much longer, and that's precisely why they had to make these summaries, especially for people who wanted to include them in the prayers, or after prayers. There are those who disagreed. The Rav was famous for arguing that it's inappropriate to recite these even after prayers. He thought this was a violation of Chukos Hagayim, that it resembled a catechism, the Catholic practice to recite principles of faith, and he thought that those who added it or do it at the end of davening were copying. There's a prohibition in the Torah of Chukos HaAkum, which on its basic level means that copying religious practices from non-Jewish religions, and especially idolatrous religions, is problematic. Some people say that, some people didn't say it. The Rav didn't think that these weren't important, but he just thought that the way of incorporating them as something that we recite was inappropriate. But anyway, back to our question. So why is it that the Rambam was the first to formulate them? The Rambam will tell us, as we'll read, that he's not making these up. In fact, after each of the 13 principles, more or less, he quotes a pasuk. He says, how do I know that? And he quotes a pasuk as a source. But why wasn't a list organized? So I think there are a number of answers to this question, and they're probably many of them could be true simultaneously. I'd like to read with you a passage from Rav Kook. Rav Kook is not answering this question, but it's a beautiful passage, and I think it does address this point. This is the second source on the page. We'll read from the third line here. This is in translation. Obviously, this can't quite capture the beautiful poetry in Rav Kook's writing. The greatest impediment to the human spirit, on reaching maturity result from the fact that the conception of God is crystallized among people in a particular form, going back to childish habit and imagination. Here he's discussing the topic of atheism. Atheism was a very, very popular position 100 years ago when Rav Kook wrote this. It's making a comeback nowadays. But Rav Kook, in his typical style, as opposed to just saying it's treif and, you know, we have nothing to do with it, looks for the purity and the value of atheism. And he says, well, what causes atheism? And he's especially bothered by atheism, as he writes elsewhere, because he thinks that it's totally illegitimate from an intellectual perspective. Agnosticism and having questions is something that's reasonable, but concrete, definitive denial is something that doesn't make any sense, again, cognitively, intellectually. And so what's it coming from? And he says that it comes from a fascinating root, that people are taught about God in their youth, when they're very young. My two-year-old and three-year-old, they're always talking about God, Hashem. And even though they're taught, they have a conception of God at a very young age, they never quite grow out of that. So even as they mature and become more sophisticated in all sorts of other ways, they will go to university and they'll study, but they maintain their childish impression of God. They still think of Uncle Maishi and, you know, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, up, down, right, left. They're left with that impression of God. So they don't develop a sophisticated, true understanding of God. They retain the conception that they were taught in elementary school or nursery school. And then when they start advancing and having questions, they find that childish conception of God a little bit ridiculous, and they reject it. But what are they rejecting? Exactly, they're rejecting this immature conception of God. So that is the cause of atheism. So what does atheism do? What's the positive value of atheism? He says, I'm going to skip a couple lines, but atheism arises as a pained outcry to liberate man from this narrow and alien pit. So human beings frequently find themselves in this pit with this childish conception of God. Atheism's value is that it forces us to confront the questions and come up with truer, more sophisticated answers. The violence of atheism will cleanse away the dross that accumulated in the lower levels of religious faith, and thereby will the heavens be cleared and the shining light of the higher faith become visible, which is the song of the world and the truth of the world. Whoever recognizes the essence of atheism from this perspective embraces the positive element in it and traces it back to its origin in holiness. Even atheism comes from holiness. And the positive value is that it forces us to confront and answer questions which we might not otherwise do. And I think that's part of the answer about why the Rambam formulated the Ikar Emunah. You referred back to the Reb Sadia Gaon and Emunos V'Deus, who also spends time focusing on questions of faith and belief, as does Rabbeinu Bachya, Ibn Pekuda, and others who preceded the Rambam. There's a wonderful letter written, and I should have brought it, describing the intellectual milieu that took place during the time of Reb Sadia Gaon. And it describes these wonderful debates in which all sorts of people would come together. It was the golden age of Muslim, of Arab philosophy, and they would ask questions and answers, and there would be debates, and there would be the religious perspective and the philosophers, and Kalam philosophy is to a large extent responding to these questions. And there's no doubt that when forced to answer questions, So we have to come up with answers, and that leaves us with a much better, more sophisticated, and truer understanding of the Ribono Shel Olam and issues of philosophy. The Rambam writes that, in Marna Vulchem, that originally the Jews had philosophy, and he cites Psukim to this effect, and Shlomo, and the like, and why is it that we don't find works of philosophy in our corpus of literature prior to, again, the Rambam and those who preceded him, Rav Sadigon and the like? And the answer is that the tsaris of galus and persecution caused us to lose interest and focus on this element. And that's why what the Rambam's doing and others like him is lahachzir atara liyoshna, to restore that which was lost. But there's no doubt that one of the things that was compelling us was the fact that we needed to answer questions. And anyone, I've been very fortunate to have been a teacher for a couple of years, and there's no doubt that one of the greatest things about teaching is the fact that you have to answer questions, and you have to come up with clear and organized ways of presenting material and answer questions and the like. And at the very least, that's what Chazal meant when they said, Talmida yoser mikulam. We learn from our Talmidim more than we even learn from our teachers, because not only do our students teach us, but they force us to address questions, answer questions. Rav Kook writes that's the positive value of atheism, and that's to a large degree why the Rambam in his time needed to formulate these principles of Emunah, because these were things that were being doubted and questioned and the like. And therefore, the Rambam came up with a response with what is necessary to believe, the proofs for it, and the like. Yes?
Maybe in the Rambam's days it was different. And Rav Kook is talking about how it can bring you to great questions and look for solutions. I think a lot of Americans nowadays, they say, I don't believe in God, period, end of sentence. Now we go to the movies or play ball, and they just ignore the whole thing. So for them, they're not going to read the Marna Vulchem, and they're not going to be prompted to solve the mysteries.
That may be true. So find out another solution. Okay. Yes?
I'm not sure about something you said. Uh-huh. Does that mean from the period of the Mishnah through the Amoraic period and Saboraic period, there was no need to address these philosophical issues?
So,
even though much of that was also in Gaulis, and
so that's a good question, and you would have to speak. We would have to speak to a historian to find out a little more. I'm not a historian. But my understanding is yes, on two levels. First of all, it was during this time of Rambam and the centuries preceding him, like Rav Haigon and the like, Rav Sadiagon, where this flourished on the world in general, what we've mentioned before is the golden age of Islamic philosophy and the like. So that had a lot to do with it in a broader world. It's also true that the Jews during the Amoraic period and the Savoraic period, the early Gaonic period, were much more enclosed and had very little to do, even commercially, with their neighbors. It was an agrarian society. That's one of the reasons, again, just another facet of this. Why is it that it's only in Christian Europe you see, for example, the development of the halacha in terms of dealing with all sorts of problems of yayin nesach and shutfus with gayim and the like? These were issues that arose in Ashkenaz that weren't addressed by the Gaonim and the Gemaras, because it was no problem. You know, it was okay to say something like Shlosha yamim kodem edehem, we're not going to have maso matan and the like. And during as interaction increased both commercially and others, there had to be a response. The halacha now had to deal with new realities, new questions which weren't dealt with before, because the changing situation. So the answer, as far as I know, and as I'm not a historian, this is not my level of my area of expertise. I don't know if I have any area of expertise, but it's not this. But my understanding is that there was less interaction, and even in the non-Jewish world, there was much less focus on the study of philosophy. Whereas at this point in time, there was a lot of interaction and a large focus on philosophy, and it's in that historical and intellectual milieu that we place this. Again, the Rambam wasn't at the beginning of this, but the Rambam was part of it.
So in our day, is this investigation restricted to the Torah Mada kind of community of so-called centrist modern orthodoxy, mm-hmm. or is it also something engaged in by a yeshivish or a guda?
Right. There really is a wide range, and that's an interesting sociological question, which I don't... Now is not the time to focus on. Philosophy is not particularly popular anywhere nowadays, even in the Torah Mada community, and certainly in the non-Torah Mada community. But there are certainly those who are bothered by the issues and have studied them, and while it's not, I don't know if it's a mass movement, and again, lots and lots of people will study the Yud Gimel Yikra Emunah. They might not ask these questions or consider these issues. They might, it's Pashut. What's the Shaila? This is Dashdeit. All right, so
some of them might answer the question about asking the questions.
Right.
Okay.
All right, so let's actually start with that brief introduction. What do the Ikari Emunah say? So you have before you all 13 principles over the next 5-6 pages. The Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah are from the Perash Mishnayos LaRambam, as we mentioned. The Perash Mishnayos was written in Arabic. There are a couple of translations. The standard is the Ibn Tibbon. We're using here, on the right side, is the translation of Yosef Kapach, which is a modern translation. Kapach was nifter about a decade ago or so. And I believe it's the best translation. And he also... There's also an issue we'll raise it
so
later.
This is an English translation of a Hebrew translation.
No, the English translation is a translation.
Mark Murman.
Yes, is a translation of the Ibn Tibbon translation. Okay. So it's a double translation. So it's a double translation of the worst translation. I'm including it here not because I think it's the best translation. The best translation I think is the Kapach edition. I'm including it because it's available on the internet, and therefore easy to copy and paste and put for you over here, as you could see the citation if you want to get it inside. We're not going to read through all of it, but you could always look at both translations.
Even Pekuda and Kapach do the same
Ibn
thing? Ibn Tibbon and Kapach
both
thing?
Translated the Arabic.
Why did Kapach find it was necessary?
Because two reasons. Ibn Tibbon didn't include the second edition, uh-huh. and second of all, because there are mistakes.
Uh-huh.
Now, I can't assess the mistakes because I don't speak Arabic, but Rav Kapach, who was an expert in Arabic, he was a Taimani, felt that there were.
Uh-huh.
So, again, when you can't use the original, if you really want to focus, you take all the translations you have available and you copy and you compare and you look, but that's not what we're going to be doing today. Okay, so number one is pretty straightforward. Ha'isod ha'rishon metzius ha'bor yishtabach. The existence of the Creator. He says here, yes.
May I make a suggestion? Are we going to be doing this more than just tonight?
Yes.
Okay. Because otherwise I'd suggest we just go quickly through all the principles.
Yeah.
And we're going to run out of time.
No, we'll continue the next week. So the first principle is the existence of God. This relates to a topic we did again a number of weeks ago, the idea that God does not just exist, but he is a necessary existent. What that means to say is that it's inconceivable that he wouldn't exist. All other existence depends upon his existence. His existence does not depend upon any other existence. It's conceivable that all other existence would cease to believe, would cease to exist, but his existence depends not upon them, and is, as we said, necessary. And elsewhere, the Rambam proves, in the beginning of the second section of Mar Nebuchadnezzar, offers four proofs, more or less cosmological proofs, for the existence of God. That's number one. Number two is the unity of God, the oneness of God. What we say when we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, the pasuk associated with the first of the Ikar Yemuna is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, and the second is Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. What do we mean when we say God is one? So the Rambam here tells us we mean to exclude a number of things, but put most basically, we mean to preclude two different things. Number one is that God is one and not two, or not three, or not a pantheon of gods. There is one God who is the source of everything. So there's not a God of good and evil. There is not a trinity. One, not two, not three, not four. We also mean to say that God is one in the sense that he is simple, that he is pashut, meaning to say he's not comprised of parts. There's one pen in my hand, but it's a pen that's comprised of many parts. There are molecules that make up this pen, and those molecules could be further divided into protons, neutrons, electrons. Moreover, this pen is one of many in a species. This is one pen, but I could refer to pens, and then I could classify that even more broadly as writing utensils, and I could classify that more broadly as means of tools of communication. So God is one in the sense that he's not two. He's one in the sense that he's simple. He's not comprised of parts. Now, not being comprised of parts implies many additional things. For example, principle number three, that God is incorporeal, that he has no body. That is a direct corollary of principle number two. If God was physical, then he would be comprised of parts. Anything physical is divisible. It implies other things. His simplicity tells us, for example, that he can't have positive characteristics, except for perhaps existence, and even that is a separate issue. I am one, but there are different parts of me, right? There is me and my personality. Right? Me and my wisdom, the knowledge that I know. Those are external, they're not essential qualities. For example, they could be lost. A person can know a lot of things and develop amnesia and then forget them, and then relearn them. They weren't part of him at one point. They gained them, they could go back and forth. These are not essential qualities. So that is another thing that is implied by God being simple, but God being one. So number three is, again, the denial of corporeality, the denial of physicality. This is a major issue for the Rambam and those that preceded him, because it's clear that there was a widespread belief, both among non-Jews and among Jews at his time, that God has a physical body. Not necessarily the type of physical body that we have, but the notion that something could exist but be entirely non-physical is something which is abstract and difficult to imagine. And therefore, it was commonly accepted that there is some type of physical dimension or element of God. And one of the reasons for that conception is the many places in the Torah which imply corporeality. We have psukim that refer to God's arm. Hashem took us out of Egypt, Biyad Chazakah. We have psukim that describes God's coming up and going down. God descended to look upon stone. On the night of the Exodus, God descended and took us out of Egypt. In this week's parsha, we have Anochi Eredimcha, I will go down with you to Egypt, Anochi Alcha Gamalo. Now, there were many earlier thinkers that were also very troubled by this issue. As the Rambam points out, that the Onkelos, for example, one of his major goals in his translation is to deal with implications of his gashmas, of corporeality. So frequently, when it refers to God, it will be described as kavod nivra, for example, the shechina, the presence. There's actually a debate in this Parsha in the Ramban. If you're interested in this topic, a beautiful and lengthy Ramban in this week's Parsha, Parshas Vayigash, where the Ramban actually disagrees with the Rambam. He thinks that isn't the primary motivation of Unkelus. He has Kabbalistic agenda as well. But the Rambam, of course, was not the first to deal with it. And in dealing with those questions, the Rambam over here refers to the statement in the Talmud and elsewhere that Dibra Torah Kelashon B'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in a language of man. And basically this means that these anthropomorphic references are allegorical or metaphorical, that they're not meant to be read or interpreted literally. Indeed, most of the first section of the Guide to the Perplexed, the Guide to the Perplexed is three sections, most of the first section, the first 50 chapters or so, deal with the issues of corporeality in Tanakh. And the Rambam actually writes at the beginning that this is a book, the purpose of this book, the Mor Nebuchim. Mor Nebuchim, he says, is not meant to be a purely philosophical work, though that's the way we approach it frequently. That's why one of the reasons why people skip the first 45 chapters, except for the first couple chapters. But it's meant to deal with the psukim in the Torah that a student of philosophy might be bothered by. And much of that is anthropomorphisms. So clearly the Rambam here, as I said, is coming to fight what was a rather common belief at his time. Now, it might have been a belief that was held primarily by those who were simple and unlearned, but as we know from the Ravid's critique, not the Ravid here, but the Ravid in Hilchos Tshuva, that there were even great people who seemed to have had a physical understanding of God, and the Ravid writes that they were misled by the psukim and even more the midrashim that, if understood literally, imply that. There's a Gemara that talks about God's tefillin. God's wearing tefillin. What parshios are in God's tefillin? Well, if you understand that Gemara literally,
where did he put them?
So then that would imply that God has an arm or something. Can't the right?
Left arm, of course.
There's a left arm. There we go.
Which is not the Zerah and Tzuyah, which is the right arm.
So that's...
Is that what the Ravid says? Great people, yes. Great in the Rambam have believed this.
Yeah, right. That's a topic that we're going to do. We're going to do next week.
It's
okay.
It's in your short sheet.
Yes, it is in the short sheet. All right, we will do... what we will... The Rambam, by the way, says that what pasuk is this based off of? V'zah ha'yisod ha'shlishi hu asher moreh alav ma'ashenemar on the top of the right of page 2, ki lo re'item kol tmuna, that when the Torah recounts matan Torah, the psukim stress again and again, ki lo re'item kol tmuna, you did not see any image when you went to Har Sinai. Yes, there was the Anan, there was the Eish, there was the Kol Gadol, but there wasn't an image. Now, of course, the psukim also refer to tachas raglav kiliv nasa sapir, which the Rambam addresses what that means, what's the metaphor over there. There is, of course, a very important question that can be raised here, and that is that if it's... why does the Torah then use these types of words? The basic answer that the Rambam alludes to in the Mor Nebuchim is that this was necessary for the most people to be able to understand the Torah. The Torah was written to be understood by all Jewish people at a basic level. And therefore it had to use these types of metaphors and the like for that to be accomplished. Now different people present this differently. The way Rabbeinu Bachya, when addressing this question in Chovos Olvavo, says is that it was written in such a way that those who are able to understand will understand that it's a metaphor, and those who won't will be taught correct messages. And the Rambam doesn't use that here, but he does say that elsewhere. He says that when the Torah refers to God's jealousy, for example, it does so because it imparts an important belief, namely that people will be afraid to sin. And those who understand will realize that, of course, God does not have any emotion, certainly not jealousy. And those who don't understand, at the very least, they will be motivated to do that which is right. This is something that also we could expand upon. So we did the first three, and God willing, next week we'll begin with four. Have a wonderful evening and a wonderful week.
Thank you.
Rambam also likes to say that